then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your mind upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 4th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, the first thing I want to do on this 237th anniversary of the old empire's independence is to give a shout-out to some guys who want to leave it. Racial greetings from all of us here to Don, who is on his scouting trip in Whitefish, Montana, and who's apparently loving every minute of it. Hope you can find a great place to settle and make your new life in the homeland, Don. Also, racial greetings to Mike in New York, although not the same Mike who took the photos of my great-grandfather's grave. This is another Mike, who's already been out here once and whose permanent arrival we're looking forward to next month, if he's on schedule. Right, I think it's ironically suitable that we begin the show on this profoundly historic date by talking about one of the most glorious aspects of life in Obama's America. Now, on this wonderful anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, I think we should contemplate what men like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin would have thought of federal agents or assets or general thugs in the employ of a mulatto African president of the United States being paid taxpayer dollars to murder people who think and write and say things that our baby shit brown master and the Jews who are handling him don't like. Now, as many of you know, under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011, the Democrats have appropriated unto their president, i.e. whoever they've got sitting in the Oval Office at the time, the legal authority to execute American citizens without charge and without trial, which is actually a much greater power than the King of England possessed back in 1776. The official version of this story is that this only applies to blowing up dark-skinned Muslims on the street in foreign countries with drones. But that's not what the law says. Technically speaking, Obama, or so-called competent federal authority, can order goons in black body armor, or else very expensive suits, to come to someone's home and simply shoot a political dissident dead on his doorstep, and it would all be perfectly legal. The dictatorship isn't doing that so far, at least not so far as we know. But then it's entirely possible that we simply wouldn't be told if he was, and withholding that information from the public would also be perfectly legal. Now, we know that the cops simply gunned down certain suspects who frightened the system, like that crazy nigger Christopher Dorner and that white ex-con whom they claim assassinated the commandant of the Colorado Forced Labor Camp system. What the hell was his name? Evan Abel. I think we all pretty much accept that in certain cases where individuals are frightening too many people with money and power, and they're on too many media, and they're too visible, when the steroid thugs finally catch these individuals, they'll just be shot without trial like a mad dog, or at least a troublesome dog. These are the same cops who claim that they can't do anything about the thousands of gangbang murders every year. They can't do anything about nigger flash mobs who are being assembled by Facebook and Twitter to attack whites and loot stores. I've always had suspicions about the way that conservative newsmeister and publisher Andrew Breitbart died, given the number of substances which can be used to generate an artificial heart attack in a man of 43. Now it looks like the lefties may have their own martyrs to the NDAA, including left-wing journalist Michael Hastings, who died in a mysterious solo car crash a couple of weeks ago. It seems that only a few hours before his death, Hastings emailed his circle of contacts, informing them that our friends in the silk suits had come cruising, questioning his friends and co-workers and seizing hard drives to mine data about Hastings, so forth and so on. Hastings had claimed that he was onto a big story about one of the Obama scandals. Maybe his mysterious end can be seen as a warning to the media that even liberals aren't immune from corrective discipline if they incommode Obama and his liberal and Jewish handlers. Now, the car crash that killed Michael Hastings is in fact very similar to what might have happened to our own Mike Harris last Friday. I was scheduled to do a call-in show with Mike that day, but I was contacted and told that he couldn't make it into the RentsRadio.com studio. I eventually did that show with Mike on Monday, July the 1st, and I'll just let him tell it.
My guest today is author and social commentator Harold Covington. Harold, are you there? Well, good. Well, first thing I have to do is I have to apologize because Harold was supposed to be my guest on Friday, and I had some mechanical issues on a vehicle that I drive that left me stranded on the side of the road. And the good news is that if I would have followed my daily pattern, I would have went north and I would have had to go through some steeper mountain grades instead of going south where it's all flat and level. So fortunately, I lucked out. I dodged a bullet. But let me give you a little bit of history here, and maybe the listeners can appreciate this. But I bought this vehicle used. It's got the original 12-cylinder Cummins turbo diesel engine in it, 12-valve Cummins turbo diesel, which was the agricultural motor. It's the most robust engine there is, and there's no electronics in this vehicle. There's a radio that's electronic, and there's a speedometer that has an electronic connection, and there's a part on the starter that is electronic. But that's it. There's nothing else. So there's no chance to doing Boston brakes. Since I ran, when I bought the vehicle, it had a bad master cylinder, so I replaced the master cylinder in December of 2010, January of 2011, sometime like that. Since I've started with Rents Radio, November of last year, I've had to replace three master cylinders. Three, count them, three. That just seems anomalous to me that I would have to replace three master cylinders. That's not what happened to me on Friday. On Friday, I was driving down the road and a universal joint failed, because a retaining pin, a retaining clip, had been removed from it. And as my mechanic friend was working on the vehicle, trying to put the new U-joint in, he said, let me check your other ones. All three of the U-joints in that drivetrain had had the retaining clips removed. And that kind of gives me a hint that maybe I'm suffering some form of harassment or something is going on here about this. I don't really know what to make of it. But you couple that with the fact that about a week and a half before, on a Thursday night, my dog was perfectly healthy when I went to bed. And when I got up in the night, he was severely distressed and throwing up all night and was sick for 2 days. I really think that maybe the things I say are offending some people and they're trying to give me some not so subtle hints that maybe I better change my tune and shut up. Well, guys, it ain't going to work. In fact, if that's your A game, forget about it, because I had two choices. I could either roll this over to the police, or I could roll this over to my business partners at Adamus Group, and my business partners at Adamus tell me that they're going to take this to a whole new level. So you guys either better pick up your game or get off the field. That's it. That's how it is. So that being said, Harold, how are you? And I apologize for having to stiff you on Friday.
Oh, not at all. I get it. I suffer from strange, odd little occurrences like this myself. If I could interject there, my personal guess is that when you really ticked him off was when you reported on that JT Ready thing down in Arizona. But
That was one of the things that I've probably ticked him off about. It's time. Well, they just killed Michael Hastings. That's pretty obvious. I mean, I've read several different issues with this. I've heard from my contacts that they feel that they can't tell me how, why they feel this, but they think that his car was hit by a Predator drone firing some sort of a missile to take out his car. But the fact that a new Mercedes C250 does not blow up when it hits a tree, and the fact that the engine was catapulted out of the car 180 feet away from where the impact was tells me that that was quite an impact. There was some explosive device was employed. Whether it was a bomb attached to his car or whether it was a missile, some explosive device struck his vehicle. You look at all of that with all of these other things that are going on, and you look at who our current Department of Homeland Security Secretary is. That's the woman who I wanted to displace back in 2006 where I ran for governor of Arizona. And these people hold grudges. I'm sorry, but they hold grudges.
And I'll be uploading that complete podcast of the Mike Harris Show for July the 1st to the NorthwestFront.org website sometime within the next week, probably on Sunday. Now, on yet another subject involving the violation of American civil liberties, specifically mine, and some fella in Texas, which I think is an appropriate topic for us to speak of 237 years after the Founding Fathers signed a document committing themselves to end this kind of thing. Last week, our friends in the silk suits from not one but two, count 'em two, agencies apparently descended on the home of a man in Texas and spent almost 2 days searching the place from top to bottom, digging up his property, stealing his hard drives, and interrogating him about, well, about me and the Northwest Front, actually. I'm not sure why they thought this man had any knowledge at all of NF activities. Now, he and I have never met. I seem to recall that he was on the mailing list for a while, but he was dropped for non-response, which is the reason that most people are dropped. They simply wander off and we never hear from them again. No idea where they are, what they're doing, or even if they're still interested in anything racial. He hasn't responded to any of my queries, so I assume that means that they stole all his computer gear. I've Googled him, and he hasn't been arrested for anything, or if he was arrested in secret, which is also legal now and has been since the Patriot Act. And yet the droids seem to feel that this man knew something about me and about the Northwest Front, and so they interrogated him over the course of 2 days. This is a guy in Texas now, and so far as I know, never been to the Northwest in his life. Now, I obviously don't want to talk about my source here, but apparently these Maroons are still trying to locate the NVA, which, as anyone who is at all familiar with my work will know, is a completely fictitious organization and does not exist. Nonetheless, the NVA is apparently being hunted by the FBI, kind of like a mystical quest for a unicorn. After some thought, my guess is that if they're trying to dig up something on me from such peripheral sources, it may be because I pissed them off regarding my support for Bill White, especially rerunning the David Gehary interviews. Now, the guy America Farm, who runs the Bill White trial update site, was visited a few weeks ago, and they scared his wife into getting him to clam up for a couple of days, although he later recovered his nerve and he started rebuilding the site. Now, for some reason, these people have an incredible case of the ass over Bill White, and they're freaking out over the fact that he still won't shut up after all they've done to him. That's the only thing I can figure. I'm sure that, like leaker Edgar Snowden has informed us, they're watching every move my computer makes, including this one, and of course, they're listening to this podcast. Hi, guys. Now that it's all politically correct, are you ready to talk about Mary in public yet? I'm not sure how I can prove to the FBI or anybody else that the NVA does not exist. As I said back in February, it's very hard to prove a negative, possibly because niggers and Jews and FBI men aren't dropping dead of lead poisoning on the streets of Seattle and Portland. Maybe that would indicate to these turkeys that what they're looking for doesn't exist. Who knows? Or, more sinister still, could some faceless bureaucrat sitting in an air-conditioned cubicle in Washington, D.C. have decided that if the NVA doesn't exist, it should? Are the FBI going to fabricate an NVA just like they fabricated the Edgar Steele audio tapes? So all of a sudden, here's this big, huge domestic terrorist menace, and all those frightened leeches in Congress who feel their power threatened will run to load the Bureau up with all kinds of multi-billion dollar budgets and fancy high-tech toys to defend them against the wicked and evil Northwest Volunteer Army. Is that supposed to be the scenario? Who knows? I'm not making this up, you know. I wish I was. It's a bit chilling for me to realize that I have people who are that powerful and that bloody bird-brained stupid, or else who are just plain that vile and evil, on my trail. Seriously, this is one of two things. It's either sheer ignorance on their part because these federal agents have read my books, or more likely they've had somebody else summarize my books for them in some grotesque FBI version of Cliff Notes. I would imagine, actually, that the Bureau would be a little bit nervous about white agents reading my material, especially white male agents. Might give them some ideas. Anyway, it could be that these people really do think that I'm describing a real situation and that the NVA really exists. I guess maybe we're hiding out in the woods like Sasquatch. And yes, I have had even that suggested to me, that that's the reasoning the FBI is using, that if the Northwest forests are sufficiently vast and unexplored so that a large ape-like primate called Sasquatch has been able to escape detection, then maybe Harold Covington could have some kind of secret guerrilla army stashed out in the woods as well, maybe a couple of panzer divisions. And yes, I think it's possible that they really are that fucking stupid. Now bear in mind, these are not the spick and span, spit-shined, buzz-cut Mormon boys of J. Edgar Hoover's day, when FBI agents were required to be either attorneys admitted to the bar or certified public accountants before they could even apply to join the Bureau. These are secret police whose purpose is to keep the ruling party in power. The Democrats have won the tussle now that they're getting the illegals amnestied, finally, and career-minded agents are no doubt rushing forward to sell their souls to the dictatorship at the best price they can get. Now, the FBI has been corrupted by two generations of ideologically motivated politicization of the Bureau, by affirmative action which has allowed incompetent women and non-whites to assume positions of authority, and by the general decay of American moral fiber as a whole. Now remember, 60 years of counterculture and political correctness hasn't just poisoned and rotted our potential recruitment pool. It's done the same thing to the dictatorship. Now, every couple of months, the media carries stories of FBI men and Secret Service personnel engaging in drunken shenanigans, vandalism, drug abuse, hiring hookers in Colombia, refusing to pay the hookers, abuse of authority, as in fixing traffic tickets and tampering with evidence and criminal charges, drunken disorderly conduct, including firing off their weapons in bars and restaurants, DUIs, hit and runs, drug problems, kids and family members with drug problems, stealing drugs from evidence lockup, you name it. Federal agents' lives are just as screwed up as ours are, except their divorces are messier because they have more money and they can afford greedier and more vicious lawyers. And they have federal health care insurance to pay for years of therapy for their kids. Then you have incidents like the John Connolly episode, wherein an FBI supervisory special agent was actually an informer for the mob instead of vice versa. A couple of months ago in Virginia, a Mexican FBI agent was arrested for murdering his wife. I mean, it goes on and on. You know, things like that simply didn't happen when J. Edgar Hoover was in charge. Bugger boy or not, Mary or not, now I'll give him that much. J. Edgar might have liked dressing up in women's clothing like Benny Hill, but he actually had a high degree of respect for American civil liberties, higher than you'll find anywhere in government today. For all his many quirks and faults, and I don't deny them, old man Hoover actually believed in the system that he served and he practiced what he preached. Okay, he spied on Eleanor Roosevelt and Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, but they deserved to be spied on, because they were up to no good. You know that there is a persistent rumor that Hoover had Marilyn Monroe's house and phone bugged, and that he actually caught the actress's murder on tape? And while no one knows if Bobby Kennedy and Peter Lawford actually gave her the hot shot themselves, they were sufficiently involved so that from that moment on, Hoover's job was safe from the Kennedys or any other Democrat. Anyway, I've discussed our friends in the silk suits before. They're an important part of our reality today, and that's unfortunate, because from what I know of these historic figures, I do know that Jefferson and Washington and John Adams and Patrick Henry didn't do and say what they did and devote their lives to creating a country which would be a surveillance state, where the government watches everybody all the time. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that if these men were alive today, they'd be horrified at what's happening. The FBI, as it is now constituted, should not even exist in this country. Not that there's much that I can do about any of this. If they're going to get me, they're going to get me. I stopped worrying about it long ago. I assume that they are aware that I don't break the law. And I'm sure that frustrates the hell out of them. And yeah, it's pretty creepy knowing that somewhere out there in the mist, there are powerful and evil beings who are hunting me, trying to destroy me. But I long ago decided that as creeped out as I am, I will not allow them to make me afraid. And I will not be terrorized into failing in my duty. Like Martin Luther. Here I stand. I can do no other. Okay, here's a Northwest Liberation song done on acoustic instruments for once from our Kentucky balladeer, Lawrence. Let me know what you think and I'll pass your comments on to him.
People, can't you see? People, can't you see? They're killing you, they're killing me. We've all got sacrifices to make. All begins when we choose to migrate. People, can't you see? It's genocide for you and me. And people, it's time to choose. Will we stand and make that move? We've all got sacrifices to make. All begins when we choose to migrate.
Comrades, tonight I'd like to talk about the career of Houston Stuart Chamberlain. When we look at his career, we see various themes emerging. And one theme that emerges very early on in his life is this sense of foreignness. Now, as we all know, he was born English, but apparently his mother was educated by a German governess, and she spoke only German to him. And then when Houston Stuart Chamberlain was very young, she dies. And then they really didn't know what to do with Chamberlain, so he was taken to live with a maternal grandmother, and she lived at Versailles. Now, she was very strict, and at Versailles, Chamberlain learns to speak French, and he becomes very fluent. But he doesn't have any friends, or very few friends, and he feels very disconnected and very foreign. So he's sent eventually to a private academy in England. He finds that he's very unsuited to the school because he is not athletic. He also is unwell. And we do see illness as another theme throughout his life. He finds solace in religion, namely through concentration on the personality of Jesus. But he never has a crisis of faith, even though he develops an interest in science, which is another theme that we'll see in his life. This English school that he's sent to doesn't really work out very well, and again he becomes ill, and he's sent back to the continent. It's expected that this will only be a break from the school, however, he never returns to that particular school. Eventually, he has this tutor by the name of Otto Kuntz, and at this point, he starts to become interested in botany, and that will be another theme. He also learns German, and eventually Otto becomes his full-time tutor. Eventually, because Chamberlain is unwell, his father decides that Chamberlain is never going to be able to go into the English military like his father expected. And for a time, his family believes that he might become a farmer in Canada. But that also proves to be rather a fantasy, because really his health is not good, and he cannot tolerate a cold climate. So eventually his family allows him to go to Switzerland, where he's going to study botany. Now, while he's in Switzerland, he ends up meeting his first wife, Anna Hurst, or Horst, I should say. Now, she's 10 years older, and so the marriage is a bit controversial. But eventually, after Chamberlain's father dies, he does get married, spends a bit of time in Florence, but decides that he doesn't want to stay there. And at this time in his life, he does end up finishing his master's finally, and then he gets a bit bogged down in his PhD. He never seems to quite finish it. His interests are always darting about here and there, it seems. But finally, as he starts getting settled in, he becomes more and more interested in Wagner. At around this time, he starts developing an interest in finance, possibly to fund the Wagner movement, because there's a lot of wealthy people getting involved in that. Over time, he does lots of various things, but he starts getting involved in a patron's society and starts getting involved in writing articles for various magazines on Wagner. One of the things that's very helpful to Chamberlain is that he speaks French, he speaks German. Apparently, he also speaks some other languages, so he's really able to write articles for various magazines. Now, one of the things that's a bit frustrating about writing for all these magazines is that he's always slanting the article to work for his audience. And even though he doesn't really like doing that, it's an effective tool. Over time, he starts getting more and more into the Wagner circle, and he gets more and more enthralled with the regenerative mission of Wagnerian art. And at one point, after Wagner's death, he's asked to write a biography, and he really has to clean up the story of Wagner's life. And he's trying to make Wagner a bit more comprehensive to the general reader. There's one incident, actually, from 1848 that he has to smooth over, because at one point, apparently, Wagner was involved with something called the Bavarian Revolution, and for 15 years, he's exiled from Bavaria, and Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who's rather conservative and really a monarchist, has to sort of smooth over this incident. Houston Stuart struggles with this idea of whether art can get involved with social philosophy. And so we see that struggle. He does some traveling. He goes to Serbia at one point. Eventually, he does end up getting a divorce. And eventually, he actually marries Cosma Wagner's daughter, the youngest daughter, who at the time was in her 40s. Now, another project that Chamberlain does, he's asked to write a kind of encyclopedic overview of the achievements of the 19th century, and this overview is called Foundations, and he completes the first two volumes, but As we often see in Chamberlain's life, he never actually completes the last two volumes because he starts to write about Goethe and also about Kant. He's never really very fond of Darwinism, so he really takes that on and he offers Goethe's vitalism as an alternative to Darwinism. So he's very much, he's also very much ensconced in Christianity. And so I would imagine that someone interested in Christian identity would probably be more receptive to Chamberlain than possibly others would. This issue of Wagnerism that we see, in a way, this Wagner movement was similar to other movements going on at the time, so the arts and crafts movement, for example. But, of course, as we know, there's a lot of folkish overtones to the Wagner movement, and a lot of very folkish individuals got involved. And, of course, there was a lot of overlap between the patronage groups and other groups. You know, Wagner was very concerned about Jewish influence on art. The thing that at that time in Germany, you were seeing a lot of modernization, and there was the issue of Jewish emancipation, which was a controversy, and that was apparently a ruling where Jewish people could become more involved in the society. Now, another influence on Wagner was the writings of Gobineau. Although Wagner was far less pessimistic than Gobineau was. During the First World War, in the year 1916, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who has always really been looking at things through a continental lens for many years, actually becomes a German citizen. Although, interestingly, in 1915, he's awarded an Iron Cross, so he actually gets that before he becomes a German citizen. Now, in 1927, Chamberlain dies, and Hitler comes to his funeral. Apparently, some relatives of Wagner apparently are there. There's a prince that comes to the funeral who represents exiled Kaiser. So, apparently, I mean, you can see that he gets very deep into the Wagner circle at the end of his life, or really, well, throughout his life. So, he has this very interesting, very long career, and it seems that his ideas would seem, I suppose, very old-timey to us now, but I thought it was an interesting topic for study, and would be a nice topic for this show. So, I hope you enjoyed it. So, thank you very much for listening.
Two 237 years after our founding fathers signed the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia, we live under a regime which is heading toward a one-party dictatorship, and which will become a one-party dictatorship in the year 2014, when the last of the hapless conservative Republicans will be chased out of Congress, and the Democrats will seize total control forever. This dictatorship clearly calls for the forced physical, social, cultural, and biological admixture of white Americans with the Negroid, Mongoloid, and Mestizo races. The ruling elite intend to achieve racial harmony by deliberately altering the racial and ethnic demographics of America and eliminating the Caucasian race through interracial marriage, or at least interracial sex, to produce a new, hybridized, raceless, classless, brown American. Everywhere we turn, in product advertisements and television dramas and situation comedies, in Hollywood movies, and indeed throughout all the mass entertainment and news media, non-whites are placed at center stage in our society. Nigger athletes and gangster rappers are held up as role models for white youngsters. All the while, white males are portrayed as fools like Al Bundy and nauseating cartoon caricatures such as Beavis and Butthead or Homer Simpson. And in the world of political correctness, one media image always predominates over all others. The racially mixed couple. We are bombarded with it to the point where most white people have now accepted that the destruction of their race is imminent. The rot began noticeably to set in back in 1933 with the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the elevation of his wife Eleanor, an unspeakable lesbian hag, to the position of First Lady. Since that time, American society and government have grown into one gigantic cesspool of moral putrefaction. White working Americans are paying for it all, in cash, in the wasted lives and empty futures our children face, and in the mongrel babies that our airheaded Kelly Bundy-type daughters are producing because they have been so cruelly and viciously deceived into betraying their race and their heritage. Who are the authors of the left liberal agenda, and whose are the guiding hands which implement the plan? Who's behind this program to destroy all standards of decency and racial self-respect, to propel young white girls who are ashamed of being white into the beds of non-whites? Who exactly is it who wants to breed a new race of mongrels? The answer is simple. It is the Jews. We can no more honestly discuss race mixing and cultural poisoning without speaking of the Jews than one can discuss disease without mentioning germs. Today, the melting pot has become a festering trash heap. We allow those infamous lines written by the Jewess Emma Lazarus about giving us the world's wretched refuse to be written on the Statue of Liberty. And that's what we've gotten in spades. Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Haitians, Mestizo Cubans, Hispanics of every stripe, Filipinos, Russian Jews, Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, Cambodians, Laotian Montagnards, Ethiopians, Somalis, Arabs and Muslims of every Middle Eastern backwater. All are pouring across our borders unchecked and spilling off every airplane that lands and every ship that docks in this country. For all practical purposes, there is no immigration control of any kind in the United States. They're taking our jobs, our hospital beds, our welfare dollars, our medical and social services, our schools, and our daughters. They fill our prisons. They sell drugs to our children. They transmit AIDS and Ebola virus and West Nile and dengue fever and other infectious diseases. They depress wages by supplying an endless source of cheap labor. In many parts of this country, they have forced their native languages on the rest of us rather than learning to speak English as white immigrants did in the past. The Democrats are now well on their way toward giving them amnesty, which means that they will at long last swamp and overrun the voter rolls and ensure Democrat rule in a one-party state for the next century, although there's no way the United States will ever last that long. And then there are the Jews. Those wonderful, cute little fiddlers on the roof. Wherever there is organized degeneracy and corruption, wherever the Christian religion is insulted, ridiculed, and vilified, wherever the white woman is cheapened into a sex object and her role as wife and mother is mocked and degraded, wherever our daughters and our sisters are depicted in the arms of non-whites, wherever sex is commercialized and twisted into the loathsome perversions of homosexuality, sadomasochism, feminism, transvestism, pedophilia, wherever the white male and the Western civilization he created are abused, reviled, and subverted, there you will find the influence of the Jew. Always the Jew. Who created communism, one of the crucial foundation blocks of today's New World Order? The Jews, Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Karl Liebknecht, Victor Berger, Max Eastman, Daniel de Leon, Lev Bronstein, otherwise known as Leon Trotsky, with his armies of Jewish commissars. Marxism has been an offshoot of Judaism from day one. Who financed the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia? Jewish capitalist bankers such as Paul and Max Warburg, Jacob Schiff, and the Rothschild family. Who created feminism, the sexual perversion which teaches that women should liberate themselves by rejecting marriage, home, and children through lesbian sexual relationships. Jewesses like Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, Shulamith Firestone, Andrea Dworkin, Naomi Wolf, and Bella Abzug. What organizations actively promote the murder of millions of unborn white infants through abortion? The American Jewish Congress, the B'nai B'rith Women, the National Council of Jewish Women, the United Synagogues of America, the Women's League of Conservative Judaism, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, the National Federation of Temple Sisters, the American Jewish Committee, and the North American Federation of Temple Youth have all come out in favor of the pro-choice agenda. Judaism is the one major American religious denomination which gives unqualified support to abortion, except for Orthodox Jewish rabbis who are adamantly opposed to abortion for Jews only. Who created the vile counterculture of the 1960s, which now dominates our universities, our government, and our airwaves? New left Jews like Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Mark Rudd, Bernadine Dorn, Herbert and Bettina Apthecker, Allen Ginsberg, and Susan Sontag, who once described the white race as the cancer of history. In the U.S. Congress, who are the chief instigators of government violation of the Second Amendment right of all Americans to keep and to bear arms? Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, Charles Schumer, the loathsome Jew faggot Barney Frank, former Senators Howard Metzenbaum and Arlen Specter. These people took a solemn oath to uphold the United States Constitution when they assumed office, and yet they violate that oath without cavil every time they introduce, lobby, or vote for gun control legislation. Why the apparent casual willingness to violate their oaths of office? What is the basis for the Jews' universal and long-standing historical reputation for dishonesty and untrustworthiness? Every year, during the most solemn holy day on the Jewish calendar, the Kol Nidre, or All Vows Oath, is sung in Jewish synagogues. In fact, it is the liturgical high point of the annual Yom Kippur, or Day of Atonement Festival. With the following Kol Nidre oath, Jews ready themselves for another year among Gentiles. And it goes, and I quote in a translation from the Hebrew, "All vows, obligations, oaths, or anathemas, pledges of names which we have vowed, sworn, devoted, or bound ourselves to from this Day of Atonement until the next Day of Atonement, whose arrival we hope for in happiness, we repent aforehand of them all. They shall be deemed absolved, forgiven, annulled, void, and made to no effect. They shall not be binding, nor have any power. Vows shall not be reckoned vows. The obligations shall not be obligatory, nor the oaths considered as oaths." Okay, I apologize for this long and possibly boring quote that may have lost a few of you, but basically, the Jewish religion teaches them that it's all right to lie to Gentiles. It is all right to steal from Gentiles. It is all right to defile Gentiles. The Jews believe that they are God's chosen people and that everyone else on earth are what they call goyim, soulless cattle. Now, these are the people to whom the control of our money has been entrusted since 1913 through the Federal Reserve. Beautiful. Whose influence thrust Great Britain into war with China to make the Far East safe for the opium trade, which was the original drug running back in the 19th century? The Jewish Sassoon family of bankers and drug dealers. Who were the slave traders who brought the blacks to America? Here's a partial list of the Jewish owners of slave ships back in the 18th and 19th centuries. Abraham Pereira Mendez, Aaron Lopez, Moses and Samuel Levy, Jacob Franks, Isaac Levy, Nathan Simpson, Justice Bosch, John Abrams, Henry Krueger, Jacob Phoenix, Mordecai and David Gomez, Nathan Marston, Abram Lyell, William DeWolf and James DeWolf, Jan de Sweets, John and Jacob Roosevelt. Basically, the Jews were behind the slave trade. Indeed, the slave trade was almost entirely a Jewish enterprise as far as the actual financing of it went. Black captives were sold into slavery by their own chiefs or rival tribes on the west coast of Africa. This business of white men running them down and kidnapping them from their peaceful African villages is nonsense. Yankee skippers and crews captained the slave ships on the dangerous Middle Passage, and they battled the tropical storms, the deadly diseases, the hostile tribesmen on the coast, and the ever-present danger of slave revolts on board, while the Jews who financed it all sat safe in Boston, Providence, Nassau, and Charleston and reaped the profits. Yet despite the role of the Jews in bringing the blacks to this country in chains, who financed and directed the so-called Civil Rights Revolution when it served their purposes later on? Jews like Jack Greenberg of the NAACP Legal Department, Marvin Rich of CORE, Herbert Apthecker of the Communist Party USA, Jewish symphonic conductor Leonard Bernstein, who held fundraising cocktail parties for the Black Panthers, and Rabbi Israel Mill of the Rabbinical Council of America's Civil Rights Task Force. Remember that stupid Mississippi Burning movie? Of the three so-called civil rights activists who were killed by Southern partisans in that incident in 1964, one was a black and two were Jews. Who writes the scripts of television shows which ridicule traditional moral values? Wait until the end of any Hollywood movie or television sitcom and watch the credits roll. Notice all the Goldbergs, Levines, this Stein, that Stein, Silvermans, Kagans, and other obviously Jewish names. We have to stop this malicious destruction of our culture and our nation. We must refuse to allow ourselves to be deceived, indoctrinated, and intimidated by an alien people. And make no mistake about it, the Jews are an alien people in our midst. Not only are they in our midst, they're occupants of all the seats of power in this nation. They own the news media and the entertainment industry. They control the Federal Reserve Bank and thereby enjoy a stranglehold on the economic health of our people. By means of high finance, they've gained control of corporate America. Using bribery, blackmail, and deceit, they've seized control of the U.S. government, along with the power of coercive force which goes along with it. The result has been the open butchery of white separatists like the Weaver family and non-approved religious dissidents such as the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. We in white America are living under an alien occupation. If we are to survive as a race, and if civilization is to be maintained on the North American continent, we must, like our forefathers, resist this tyranny with every means at our disposal. The Northwest Front is now in the formative stages of building such a resistance. You have the moral duty to support the Northwest Front in its efforts without cavil and without stint. Will you take upon yourself this duty, this burden of history? Do you have the right stuff? This is the March of the Old Guard from the movie Waterloo. One of the most famous short pieces I ever wrote, if anything in our tiny little mostly online community can be said to be famous, is an article, or more accurately, a kind of tirade that I usually publish every year on the 4th of July. Now this year, 2013, I think instead of posting it on one of the blogs to be read, I'll do it out loud instead. It's called, Let's Talk a Little Treason. In Ireland, when a man has an old friend over for dinner, after the meal, he will usually tell his wife the traditional Irish tale. Love, Seamus and I are going down to the pub and talk a little treason. That's Brendan Behan, I think. Oh, hell, let's come right out and say it. Us white boys here in America need to be talking a little treason. I notice that the great state of Oregon is about to pass more grotesque hate crime laws in favor of sodomites, making perverts who commit the filthiest acts imaginable. You know, people really don't seem to realize just what it is that homosexuals actually do. Anyway, this new Oregon law is making these creatures a politically and legally protected class. Better than me in the eyes of the law. Better than any white man who likes girls, because they will have specific legal protection that we are denied. There is no more equality under the law. Some states are even worse. In Idaho, all women, period, are considered to be a special politically protected class under these deranged hate crime laws, effectively meaning that only heterosexual white males are without legal protection against quote-unquote hate, and only white males can be victimized on the lowest level as mere Americans. less than a woman of their own race, less than a Mexican, less than a faggot, less than a black, three-fifths of a man at best. Now, I'm going to say something now to all my fellow girl-loving white boys, and I'm dead serious. I think we need to start re-evaluating our relationship with the United States of America with a view towards bringing that relationship to an end. America gives us nothing except ridicule, hatred, contempt, and oppression. America ignores our interests, laughs at us and reviles us, picks our pockets, discriminates against us with affirmative action and racial quotas, and kicks us in the teeth when we try to protest or petition for the redress of just grievances. America rigs the electoral process so that no one without $10 million in the bank should even think about running for office, and so that only criminals, incompetents, and mentally unbalanced mediocrities can win. America passes laws that give foreigners who are in our country illegally and perverts who literally wallow in their own filth during sexual acts a preferred and privileged status over us. Every time we turn on the television, we see grinning black and brown monkey faces mocking and reviling us, mincing faggots waving their limp wrists mocking and reviling us, toilet-mouthed Jews like the loathsome Sarah Silverman spewing hatred and abuse at us, pathological liars in the White House and Congress pissing down our backs and assuring us with solemn faces that it's raining. Thanks to the media and the Jews who control the media, when the world thinks of white males, they think of revolting cartoon characters. George Washington, Daniel Boone, and Charles Lindbergh have been replaced by Homer Simpson and Peter Griffin. White women are in their own way just as much victims as white men are, although some of them haven't quite seen sufficiently through the feminist horseshit to understand that. If we can ever succeed in deprogramming our sisters and making them understand what has been done to them so that they realize that their place is by their menfolk's side and not with the Jews who hate them and hold them in just as much contempt as they do white men, calling them shiksas and so forth, well, if we can ever succeed in doing that, then you kikes had better start running. White people do the real work in this country. Mexicans and blacks do nothing that couldn't be done twice as well and at half the expense by a good cart horse. Robotics will eventually make the black man and the brown man completely obsolete. White people pay the overwhelming percentage of the taxes that finance the horror show that is America. White boys and increasingly girls are dragged into the military and come back from the Jews' foreign wars with their bodies mangled to rot in the filthy army hospitals like Walter Reed because the influx of illegal aliens has taken all the entry-level jobs in their hometowns and there's no future for white kids where they grew up. White people, especially boys, are denied access to college education, to employment, to workplace promotion, and job stability because of their skin color, because of their gender, and increasingly because of their age. I could go on and on, but if you're white, you know what I'm talking about. And if you're not white, I'm not talking to you anyway. Guys and gals, let me ask you something. What the hell do we owe a society that treats us like this? The neocons wave their red, white, and blue Masonic dish rags and babble about all this freedom we've got. Bullshit. What freedom? The freedom to never be able to get any kind of decent job because you're the wrong color and you got convict genitalia? The freedom not to be admitted to college because their quota for white boys was filled up by the sons of the wealthy elite long before you even applied? The freedom to spend 30 years in the workforce and see incompetent affirmative action employees promoted over your head year after year. What freedom? The freedom to pay one-third of your income to support stupid wars in the Middle East and protect the Jews from the consequences of their own behavior? The freedom to vote in elections where half the time these arrogant swine no longer bother to conceal the massive fraud? What freedom? The freedom to have your children corrupted by the endless tsunami of filth from the television screen and taught sodomy techniques at school? The freedom to have your son and your daughter come back from Iraq or Afghanistan or Yemen or Egypt or God knows where in a plastic bag or minus some limbs because all the jobs in their hometown have been gobbled up by illegals and the military was the only place they could get a paycheck? What freedom? The freedom to be insulted, belittled, and spat upon every time we turn on a TV or pick up a newspaper? The freedom to eventually be carried off to the living hell of some state-run nursing home when the government finally finds some way to steal the Social Security and Medicare fund and piss it away in the deserts of Iraq or blow it on the stock market, whatever. What the hell kind of loyalty do we owe to a government that has made us third-class citizens? What the hell kind of loyalty do we owe to a state that uses us like toilet paper and throws us away? Why exactly should we respect the rights of media garbage people who give us nothing but insults, contempt, and vilification? Why exactly should we allow our country to be taken over by millions of Mexican mestizos and all the overflow from the third world's sewers and never raise a hand in our own defense? Because the tyrant's law forbids it. Yeah, I know the United States of America is the law. Of course it is. Tyrants always are the law. That's why they're tyrants and not simple gangsters. The difference between Barack Hussein Obama and John Gotti is only a technicality of paperwork, except that Gotti dressed better and he killed a lot fewer people. Now, when the law is cruel and uncaring, when the law is vicious, when the law is oppression wrapped up in paper and forced down the throats of the powerless, the coerced, and the cowed, when the law is enforced by steroid-popping bullies with badges and black body armor, and jackals with briefcases, and reptiles in black robes who use it solely to maintain their own power over other human beings and to squeeze them dry of every last wretched penny they possess, when the law is being used to do you and your family harm, then you are under no obligation to obey it. In every society, there is a social contract that cuts both ways. The United States Constitution was an attempt to create such a contract, and until 1861 it worked. But we need to be very clear on this. The white American has upheld that contract and is even now upholding it as the blood of our young men, and unfortunately some young women as well, is spilled in the Iraqi desert and the Afghan mountains. It is the federal government of the United States and the squamous alien things who have stolen it away from us who have violated that social contract again and again and again over the past century. Like an abused wife, white Americans have put up with it all from our cheating, lying, thieving, murdering government. The beatings, the drinking up the rent money, the lipstick on the collar, the constant bullying and browbeating. But even the most abused spouse eventually decides it's time for a divorce. That time has come. Enough. Fuck the United States government, fuck democracy, fuck America. We've seen enough, we've had enough, and we want out. Yeah, I know. Our ancestors tried this in 1861. Well, it's time for a rematch. Here in the Northwest and any place else where white males are tired of being treated like dogs and finally decide to show the Jews that dogs have teeth. And you know something? I think if we ever do pull off the old Macbeth trick and screw our courage to the sticking point, I suspect the world will discover that as far as the baby shit brown Barack Hussein Obama goes, well, he damn sure ain't no Abraham Lincoln. This is David Bowie.
I'm you.
Okay, I'm running pretty long, but I just want to close with a personal message for all you FBI and DHS and U.S. attorney-type suits out there who are bending over the computer speakers in your office or your cubicle with your hands cupped around your ears, parsing every sentence I speak and hoping I'll say something that you can pretzel twist and taffy pull into a criminal prosecution so that you can, at long last, make me shut up. I want to get something clear with you assholes. The 4th of July is our holiday. We are the true descendants of the Founding Fathers, in spirit and largely in blood. You are not. We uphold the true spirit of American Independence Day. You do not. As bumbling and confused, as timid and frightened of our shadows as we are the true Americans. You are not, and will never be. Because you serve a third world tyrant for money. And that's nothing that Washington or Jefferson or Hancock or Patrick Henry would have countenanced for a second. George Washington would have knocked you to the ground on your ass with one blow of his mighty hand, and Benjamin Franklin would have spit all over your $1,000 suit or your Prada handbag. Now, granted, those men wouldn't have been too pleased with us either. They would have called us cowards and held us in contempt, as we only deserve. But at least they would recognize us as fellow Americans and their own descendants, and they would exhort us to mend our ways and find our souls and stiffen our spines, like they did at Concord and Monmouth and Valley Forge. You federal employees, they'd just piss on. Our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.